her eyes sinking so deeply into his. It was like she was looking at the exact center of his soul. A part of him craves her now, wants her as much as she wants him, and it tears at him. He won't be able to stop thinking about her until they're together again. I don't know anymore. I don't trust my own thoughts. I pace across the room. How do I undo this? How do I rid Olivia from his mind? I don't think it's ever been done before. I don't think it's even possible. He belongs to her now. I run my tongue along the inside of my teeth. You have to get away from here. You have to leave town. Bo stands up from the couch, and the movement makes me flinch. He walks to the fireplace, stepping in front of me, willing me to look up at him. But I can't. He unsettles me, cracks apart my insides, and I bite down on the feeling, willing it away. From beneath my eyelashes, I see his lips flatten together, and our breathing seems to settle into the same rhythm. I want him to speak, to cut through the silence, and all at once I feel lightheaded, like I might reach out for him to steady myself. But then his lips open, and he says, almost like a confession, "My brother was drowned in Sparrow." His eyes cease to blink, his body a stone outline in front of me. "What?" I lift my gaze. "That's why I'm here. Why I can't leave. Not yet. I told you he died, but I didn't tell you how. He drowned here in the harbor." "When?" My fingertips begin to tingle. The hairs on the back of my neck rise on end as if a cool breeze were gliding across my skin. "Last summer." "That's why you came to Sparrow?" "I didn't know about the Swan Sisters. I didn't know about any of it. The police told us that he'd committed suicide, that he'd drowned himself. But I never believed it." I shake my head a fraction of an inch, trying to understand. "His name was Kyle," he starts. It's the first time he said his name out loud to me. "After he graduated high school last year, he and two of his friends took a road trip down the coast. It was supposed to be a surf trip. They planned to drive all the way to Southern California, but they never made it that far." He chokes back something, an emotion threatening to spill past his bulletproof veneer. "They stopped in Sparrow for a night. I don't think they had any idea about the town, about the drownings. They were staying at the Whaler Bed and Breakfast. Kyle left his room sometime just after sunset, and he never came back. His body was found the next morning, tangled in a fishing net not far from shore." "I'm sorry," I manage, barely above a whisper. A ripple of something shudders through me, a pain that I crush back down. "He had a scholarship to Montana State in the fall. He had a girlfriend who he wanted to marry. It didn't make any sense. I know he didn't commit suicide. And he was a good swimmer. He surfed every summer. It's not like he would have accidentally drowned." He takes a step back, unmooring me, and I let out a swift breath I didn't even realize I'd been holding in. "None of them committed suicide," I say, thinking of all the boys who've waded out into the harbor, lured to their death. We look at each other, the seconds stretching out between us. "Maybe you're wrong about the Swan Sisters," he says, extending an arm to touch the mantle over the fireplace, index finger brushing over a scratch in the wood. The heat from the fire has made his cheeks flushed, his lips pink. "Maybe it's just a story that locals tell to explain why so many people have drowned. Maybe someone really is killing them. Maybe that girl in the boathouse, Gigi Klein, did do it. Not because she has some ancient witch inside her who's seeking revenge, but because she's just a murderer. And maybe she's not the only one. Maybe there are other girls who are killing too, who killed my brother." But that doesn't explain why boys have drowned in Sparrow for the last 2 centuries. I need him to believe, to know the Swan Sisters exist. Maybe it's like a cult, he answers, refusing to accept the truth. And every generation, its members drown people for some unexplained sacrifice or something. A cult? Look, I don't know how cults work. I'm just trying to figure this all out as I go. So if you really believe it's just some cult, then what? Then I have to stop them from killing anyone else. I thought you wanted to go to the police and tell them about Gigi Klein locked in the boathouse. Let them handle it. Maybe that's not enough. Maybe that's not justice. For my brother, for everyone else who's been killed. Then what? What would justice be? Putting an end to whatever is happening in this town. Killing a Swan Sister, you mean? Killing Gigi? Maybe there's no other way, he says. I shake my head. There is another way. You can leave Sparrow, I say. You can go and never come back, and maybe someday you'll even start to forget this place, as if you were never here at all. I don't mean the words I say. I don't want him to leave. Not really. Except I need him to leave so he doesn't get hurt. So he doesn't end up like his brother. A storm builds in the features of his face, a coldness in his eyes I haven't seen before. You don't know what it feels like, this pain that won't go away, he says. I know my brother would do this for me. He wouldn't stop until he found out who was responsible for my death, and he would get revenge. This town was built on revenge, I say. And it's never made anything better or right. I'm not leaving, he says with such finality that I feel my throat tighten. I look up at him, like I'm seeing him for the first time. The resoluteness in his eyes, the anger in his jaw. He's searching for a way to rid himself of the pain of losing his brother, and he's willing to sacrifice everything. Do whatever it takes, pay any price, even end someone else's life. It wasn't those girls, I tell him, pleading with him to understand. It was the thing inside them. Maybe, he answers, lifting his gaze. But maybe there's no difference between the girl and whatever evil makes them commit murder. The fire crackles, spitting out sparks onto the wood floor that darken and turn to ash. I walk to the bookshelf beside the fireplace, examining the spines of each book, looking for a way to make him understand without telling him what I know, what I can see. Why are you so certain it's real? He asks, reading my thoughts, and I let my hand fall away from one of the books. I shift onto my heels and turn to face him. He stepped closer to me, so close I could reach out and touch his chest with the tips of my fingers. I could take one swift step forward and tell him everything, tell him all of my secrets. Or I could press my lips to his and silence the turmoil rattling around inside my head. But instead, I ignore every urge snapping through my veins. I draw in my lips before I speak, careful to control each word. I want to tell you, I say, 1,000 tons of stones sinking into my stomach. But I can't. His eyes flatten on me at the same moment the fire ignites over a dry log and floods the room with a sudden burst of glowing orange light. I was right about Beau, and I was also wrong. He didn't end up in Sparrow by accident. But he's also not a tourist. He came for his brother, to find out what happened to him, and what he found here is far worse than anything he could have imagined. The pressure in my head expands. The cottage walls start to rotate off axis like a carnival ride out of control, and I feel like I might be sick. I can't stay in here with him. I don't trust myself. I don't trust my heart thumping wildly like I might do something reckless that I can't take back. I don't know what I'm supposed to feel, supposed to say. I shouldn't allow myself to feel anything. It's dangerous, these emotions. The fear pumping through my chest, cracking along each rib. My head isn't thinking straight. It's tangled up with my heart, and I can't trust it. So I walk to the door and touch the knob, running my fingers around the smooth metal. I close my eyes for a half second and listen to the sounds of the fireplace behind me. Warmth and fury, the same exploding conflict happening inside my head. Then I open the door and steal out into the evening light. Beau doesn't try to stop me. The Outsider. A year earlier, 5 days into the start of swan season, Kyle Carter left the Whaler Bed and Breakfast just as the rain lifted. The sidewalks were slick and dark, the sky muted by a cloak of soft white clouds. He had no destination, but the allure of the marina drew him closer. He reached the metal gangway that led to the marina. Rows of boats lined up like sardines in a tin can, and he spotted a girl walking down one of the docks. Ebony brown hair loose and sweeping across her back. She looked over her shoulder at him, settled her deep, ocean blue eyes on his, and then he found himself stumbling after her. She was the most stunning thing he had ever seen, graceful and enticing, a rare species of girl. And when he reached her, she stroked a hand through his dark hair and pulled him close into a kiss. She wanted him, desired him, and he couldn't resist. So he let her spool her fingers between his and pull him out into the sea. Their bodies entwined, languid and insatiable. He didn't even feel the water when it entered his lungs. All he could think about was her. Warm fingers against his skin, lips so soft they melted his flesh, eyes seeing into his thoughts, unraveling his mind. And then the ocean drew him under and never let go. Chapter 11. My mind stirs and rattles with all the secrets held captive inside it. I won't be able to sleep. Not now that I know the truth about Beau, about his brother's death. And I need to keep him safe. I make a cup of lavender tea, turn on the radio, and sit at the kitchen table. The announcer repeats the same information every 20 minutes. The identity of the two drowned boys has not yet been released, but the police don't believe them to be locals. They're tourists. Eventually, the drone of the announcer's voice bleeds into a slow, drowsy song, a piano melody. Guilt slithers through me, 1,000 regrets, and I wish for things I can't have. A way to undo all the deaths. To save the people who've been lost. Boys die all around me, and I do nothing. I don't realize I've dozed off until I hear the ringing of the telephone mounted to the kitchen wall. I jerk upright in the stiff wood chair and look to the window over the sink. The sun is barely up. It's morning. The sky is still a subdued pastel gray. I stand and fumble for the phone. Hello? Did I wake you? It's Rose's voice on the other end. No, I lie. I stayed up all night, she says. Mom kept feeding me cakes, hoping it would help me forget everything that's happened in the last week, but I was so jittery from all the sugar that it made it worse. I feel distracted, and Rose's words slip ineffectually through my mind. I keep thinking of Beau and his brother. Anyway, Rose continues after I don't respond, I wanted to tell you not to come into town today. Why? Davis and Lon are on some kind of crusade. They're questioning everyone. They even cornered Ella Garcia in the girls' bathroom at the Chowder, wouldn't let her leave until she proved she wasn't a swan sister. How'd she prove it? Who knows? But Heath heard that she just started bawling, and Davis didn't think a swan sister would cry so hysterically. Isn't anyone stopping them? You know how it is, Rose says, her voice drifting away from the phone briefly like she's reaching for something. As long as they don't break any laws, everyone would be relieved if Davis and Lon actually figured out who the sisters were. Then maybe they could put an end to all of this. There's no ending it, Rose, I reply, thinking back to my conversation with Beau last night in his cottage. He wants to end this too. An eye for an eye. One death for another. But he's never taken a life before. It isn't who he is. It will change him. I hear a ding pass through Rose's phone. Heath is texting me, she says. I'm supposed to meet him at his house. Maybe you shouldn't leave your house either, I warn. My mom doesn't know about Heath yet, so I can't invite him over here. She thinks I'm meeting you for coffee. Just be careful. I will. I mean, be careful with Heath. Why? You never know what will happen. We still have a week to go. He might drown, you mean? She asks. I don't want you to lose someone you care about. And what about Beau? Aren't you worried you're going to lose him? No, I say too quickly. He's not my boyfriend, so I don't... But I feel the lie churning inside my chest, and it takes the weight out of my words. I am worried, and I wish I weren't. Another text chimes through her phone. I gotta go, she says. But I'm serious about not coming into town. Rose, wait, I say, as if I have something else I need to tell her. Some warning, some advice to keep her and Heath safe from the Swan sisters. But she hangs up before I can. I pick up my mug of cold tea from the table and walk to the sink. I'm about to pour it out when I hear the creaking of floorboards. Were you practicing reading the leaves? She asks from the doorway. I turn on the faucet. No. You should practice every day. She's chewing on the side of her lip, wearing the black robe that hangs loose across her frame. Soon she'll be so tiny that the wind will carry her away when she stands on the cliff's edge. Maybe that's what she wants. When I meet her eyes, she's looking at me like I'm a stranger, a girl she no longer recognizes. Not her daughter, but merely a memory. Why don't you read the leaves anymore? I ask, rinsing out the mug and watching the amber tea spiral down the sink. I know this question might stir up bad memories for her, but I also wonder if talking about the past might bring her back, shake her loose from her misery. Fate has abandoned me, she answers. A shiver passes through her, and her head tilts to the side like she's listening for voices that aren't really there. I don't trust the leaves anymore. They didn't warn me. The old silver radio sitting on the kitchen counter is still on. I never shut it off before I fell asleep last night at the table, and music quietly crackles through the speakers. But then the song ends and the announcer promptly returns. She has been identified as Gigi Klein, he is saying. She left her home on Woodlawn Street on Tuesday morning and hasn't been seen since. There is some speculation that her disappearance may have something to do with the Swan season, but local police are asking anyone who may have seen her to contact the Sparrow Police Department. Do you know Gigi? Her voice shakes as she asks it, her eyes penetrating the radio. The announcer repeats the same information again, then fades to a commercial. Not really. I think of Gigi spending the night inside the boathouse, probably hungry and cold. But it's not Gigi who will remember being tied to a chair. Only Aurora, the thing inside her, will recall these frigid, shivering nights for years to come. And she will probably seek her revenge on Davis and Lon. If not in the body of Gigi Klein, then next year, inside the body of another girl. Assuming they let Gigi go eventually, and Aurora is able to return to the sea before the swan season ends. When your father disappeared, they announced it on the radio too, she adds, walking to the sink and staring out the window, pushing her hands down into the deep pockets of her robe. They asked for volunteers to search the harbor and the banks for any sign of him, but no one came out to help. The people in this town never accepted him. Their hearts are cold, just like that ocean. Her voice wavers, then finds strength again. It didn't matter, though. I knew he wasn't in the harbor. He was farther out at sea. He was gone, and they'd never find him. This is the first I've heard her speak of him, as if he was dead, as if he wasn't ever coming back. I clear my throat, trying not to lose myself in a wave of emotion. Let me make you some breakfast, I offer, walking past her. The sunlight is spilling across her face, turning it an unnatural ashen white. I open a cupboard and set one of the white bowls on the counter. Do you want oatmeal? I ask, thinking that she needs something warm to shake off the chill in the house. But her eyes sweep over me, and she grabs onto my wrist with her right hand, her fingers coiling around my skin. I knew, she says coldly. I knew the truth about what happened to him. I always have. I want to look away from her, but I can't. She's looking through me, into the past, to a time we'd both like to forget. What truth? I ask. Her dark hair is tangled and knotted, and she looks like she hasn't slept. Then her eyes slide away from mine, like a patient slipping back into a coma, unable to recall what had stirred them from unconsciousness in the first place. Gently, I pull my arm away from her, and I can see that she's already forgotten what she said. Maybe you should go back to bed, I suggest. She nods, and without any protest, she turns and shuffles across the white tile kitchen floor, out into the hall. I can hear her slow, almost weightless footsteps as she makes her way up the staircase and down to her room, where she will likely sleep for the rest of the day. I lean against the edge of the counter, pinching my eyes shut, then opening them again. Against the butter-yellow wallpaper on the far wall of the kitchen is a distorted, stretched-out shadow of me, formed by the morning sunlight spilling in through the window over the sink. I stare at it for a moment, trying to match up elbows and legs and feet. But the more I look at the gray outline against the sun-bleached daffodil wallpaper, the more unnatural it seems, like an artist's abstract sketch. I push away from the counter and head for the front door. I can't get out of the house fast enough. The skiff floats perfectly still against the dock. Not a ripple of water or gust of wind blows across the harbor. The sun is hot overhead, and a fish jumps from the surface of the water, then splashes back into the deep. I've just begun untying the boat and tossing the lines over the side when I sense someone watching me. I whip around, and Beau is standing on the starboard side of the sailboat, the Windsong, one arm raised, holding onto the mast. "How long have you been out here?" I ask, startled.
"Since sunrise. I couldn't sleep. My mind wouldn't turn off. I needed to do something."
I imagine him out here, climbing aboard the sailboat, the sun not fully risen, checking the sails and the rigging and the hull to see what's still intact after all these years and what will need to be repaired. His mind working over the problems. Anything to keep him from thinking about yesterday at the boathouse, about last night in his cottage.
"I have to stop them from killing anyone else," he had said to me.
A promise, a threat, that he would find his brother's killer.
"Are you going into town?" he asks,
his jade eyes shivering against the early sunlight. "Yeah, I have to go do something."
"I'm coming with you," he says.
I shake my head, tossing the last rope into the bow of the boat. I need to do this by myself. He drops his arm from the mast and steps over the side rail of the sailboat, then hops down onto the dock in one fluid motion.
"I need to talk to that girl in the boathouse. Gigi," he says. I need to ask her about my brother. See if she remembers him.
That's not a good idea.
Why not?
Olivia might be waiting for you.
I'm not worried about Olivia.
You should be, I say.
I think I can resist whatever powers of seduction you think she has over me.
I let out a short laugh. Have you been able to stop thinking about her since she touched you yesterday? His silence is the only answer I need. But I also feel a sharp stab in the core of my heart, knowing he's been thinking about her all night, all morning, unable to shake the image of her. Only her.
You're safer here, I tell him, stepping onto the skiff as it begins to drift away from the dock. I didn't come here to be trapped on an island, he says.
Sorry. I start the engine with a swift pull on the cord.
Wait,
he calls, but I shift the boat into gear and pull away from the dock out of reach. I can't risk bringing him with me. I need to do this alone. And if Marguerite sees him in town, she might try to take him into the harbor, and I don't know if I can stop her. Today is the annual Swan Festival in town. Balloons bounce and swerve across the skyline. Children squeal for shaved ice and saltwater taffy. A red and yellow banner stretches across Ocean Avenue, announcing the festival, with cartoon cobwebs and full moons and owls printed at the corners. It's the busiest day of the year, when people drive in from neighboring towns up and down the coast, or board buses that shuttle them into Sparrow early in the morning, then haul them back out in the evening. Each year, attendance grows, and this year, the town feels close to bursting. Ocean Avenue has been closed off to traffic and is lined with booths and stands selling all manner of both witchy and unwitchy items. Wind chimes and wind socks and local boysenberry jam. There is a beer garden selling old-style craft beers and large steins. A woman dressed as a swan sister reading palms. And even a booth selling perfumes claiming to be some of the original fragrances the sisters once sold at their perfumery. Although, everyone in Sparrow knows they aren't authentic. Much of the crowd is dressed for the period, in high-waisted gowns with ruffles at the sleeves and low necklines. Later tonight, at the stage set up near the pier, there will be a reenactment of the day the sisters were found guilty and drowned, an event I avoid each year. I can't bear to watch it. I can't stand the spectacle it's become. I push through the crowds, winding my way up Ocean Avenue. I keep my head down. I don't want to be seen by Davis or Lon. I don't need an interrogation from them right now. I leave town in the bustle of the festival, reaching the road that winds through the brambles to the boathouse. There's no way to access it except from this road. I don't have a choice but to walk straight down it. Seagulls turn and spiral overhead like vultures waiting for death, sensing it. When the road widens and the ocean comes into view, flat and glittery, the boathouse seems small and plain, more sunken into the earth than it did yesterday. Lon is sitting on a stump against the right side of the boathouse. At first, I think he's staring up at the sky, soaking up the sun. But as I inch closer, I realize he's asleep, his head canted back against the outer wall. He's probably been out here all night guarding Gigi. One leg stretched out in front of him, arms hanging limp at his sides, jaw hung slightly open. He's wearing one of his stupid floral print shirts, teal with purple flowers, and if it weren't for the dreary backdrop, he'd almost look like he was on a tropical beach somewhere, working on his non-existent tan. I move quietly, careful not to step on a twig or dried leaf that might give me away. And when I reach the boathouse, I pause to look down at Lon. For a brief moment, I think maybe he's not breathing. But then I see his chest rise and his throat swallow. The wood door isn't locked, and I push it easily inward. Gigi is still sitting in the white plastic chair, arms tied, chin to chest like she's sleeping. But her eyes are open, and she slides them up to meet mine as soon as I step inside.
I walk toward her and pull the gag out of her mouth, then take a swift step back. "What are you doing here?" she asks, lifting her chin, her cropped blonde hair falling back from her face. She stares at me through her lashes, and her tone is not sweet, but low, almost guttural. The waspy, flickering outline of Aurora shifts lazily beneath her skin, but her emerald green eyes, the same inherited color of each swan sister, blink serpent-like out at me. "I'm not here to save you, if that's what you think," I tell her, keeping my distance back from the white chair that has become her cage. "Then what do you want?" "You killed those two boys they pulled from the harbor, didn't you?" She eyes me like she's trying to understand the real motivation behind my question. What purpose I have for asking it. "Maybe." Her lips tug at the edges. She's holding back a smile. She finds this amusing. I doubt it was Marguerite. At this, her eyes broaden to perfect orbs. "Only you would drown two boys at once." She shifts her jawbone side to side, then wriggles her fingers like she's trying to stretch them, her wrists confined by zip ties. The lime green polish on her fingernails is starting to chip, and her hands look waterlogged and pale. "You came here just to accuse me of killing those boys?" she asks. I stare through her sheer exterior, beyond Gigi, finding the monster inside her, meeting Aurora's gaze. And she knows it, knows I'm looking at the real her. Her expression changes. She grins, revealing Gigi's bleached white and perfectly aligned teeth. "You want something," she says pointedly. I take a deep breath. What do I want? I want her to stop. Stop killing. Stop seeking revenge. Stop this vicious game she's been playing for too long. I'm a fool to believe she would listen to me, hear my words. But I try anyway. For Bo. For me. "Stop this," I finally say. "Stop?" Her tongue pushes against the inside of her cheek, and she examines me through lowered eyelashes. "Stop drowning boys." "I can't do much drowning tied up in here, can I?" She sucks in a long breath through her nostrils, and I'm surprised when she doesn't grimace. The boathouse smells fouler than I remember. Her eyes narrow. "If you untie me, then perhaps we can discuss this little idea of yours." I examine the zip ties around her wrists and ankles. A quick yank and I might be able to break them free. If I had a knife, I could easily slice through the plastic. But I won't do that. I won't set her loose on Sparrow again. I shake my head. "I can't." "You don't trust me?" She doesn't even try to hide the wicked curl of her upper lip or the playful arch of her left eyebrow. She knows I don't trust her. Why would I? "Trust is an irrelevant word anyway," she sneers when I don't respond. "Merely a lie we tell each other. I've learned not to trust anyone. A symptom of 2 centuries of existence. You have the time to consider such things." She tilts her head, looking at me from the side. "I wonder who you trust, who you would trust with your life." I stare at the thing beneath Gigi's skin, eyes milky white and watching me. "Who would you trust with yours?" I counter. This forces a laugh from deep within her gut, eyes watering. I take a step back. Then her laughter stops. Blonde hair sliding forward to cover part of her face. Her arms stiffen against her restraints, and her real eyes cut through me. Her mouth twists into a snarl. "No one." The door behind me suddenly bangs open, and Lon bursts into the room. "What the fuck are you doing in here?" His eyes are huge. I glance from Gigi back to him. "Just asking her a couple questions. No one's allowed in here. She'll trick you into letting her go.
That only works on the weak-minded male specimen, I tell him. His lips stiffen together, and he takes a quick step toward me.
Get the hell out of here. Unless you want to confess to being one of them, then I'll gladly lock you up too.
I glance at Gigi, who sits defiantly blinking at me, the side of her lip turned upward. She looks like she might even dare to laugh. She finds his threat amusing, but she holds it in. Then I step back out the door into the daylight. You realize the police are looking for Gigi, I tell Lon when he follows me out, closing the door behind him with a loud clatter.
The police in this town are idiots.
Maybe, but it's only a matter of time before they check the boathouse. He waves a hand in the air dismissively, his floral shirt sleeve flapping with the motion, and returns to his post on the stump, leaning back against the wall and closing his eyes, obviously not concerned about Gigi escaping.
And tell your friend Rose not to come back either.
I stop mid-stride.
What? Rose, your friend? He says mockingly, as if I don't know who she is. She was here 20 minutes ago. Caught her sneaking through the brush.
Did she talk to Gigi?
My job is to keep people out, so no, I didn't let her talk to Gigi.
What did she want? I ask, although I'm certain whatever she told him was a lie.
Hell if I know. She said she felt bad for Gigi or some crap, that it was cruel to keep her locked up. But you both had better stay away unless you want to be suspects.
His voice lowers a bit like he's telling me a secret, like he's trying to help me.
We're going to find all the Swan sisters, one way or another.
I turn and hurry up the road. Alba's Forgetful Cakes smells like vanilla bean frosting and lemon cake when I step through the door. A dozen people crowd the small store, some wearing festival costumes, kids with faces painted in glitter and gold, picking out tiny cakes from the glass cases to be boxed up and tied with bubblegum pink ribbon. Mrs. Alba stands behind one of the deli cases helping a customer, carefully placing petite fours into white boxes. Two other employees are also moving quickly around the shop, ringing people up and answering questions about the effectiveness of the cakes at wiping away old, stagnant memories. But Rose is not in the store, and I wait several minutes before Mrs. Alba is free. I press my fingertips against the glass case, hoping to get her attention.
Penny!
Mrs. Alba chirps when she sees me, her grin stretching wide across the soft features of her face.
How are you?
I'm looking for Rose, I say quickly. Her expression sags, then her eyes pinch flat. I thought she was with you. On the phone, Rose told me that she had lied to her mother, saying that she was meeting me for coffee when she was really meeting Heath. But since she obviously wasn't meeting Heath either, unless they went to the boathouse together to see Gigi, I thought Mrs. Alba might actually have seen her. I think I just got the time wrong or where we were supposed to meet, I say with an easy smile. I don't want to get Rose into trouble. I thought maybe she'd be here.
You can check the apartment, she says, turning her gaze as several more customers enter the shop.
Thank you, I answer, but she's already shuffled away to help the new patrons. Back outside, I turn right and climb the covered stairs up to the second floor. The gray shingled walls of the building are protected from the rain under a narrow roof, and at the top of the stairs, there is a red door under a white archway. I press my finger against the doorbell, and the ring echoes through the spacious apartment. Their dog, Marco, begins yapping furiously, and I can hear the clatter of his paws as he races to the door, barking from the other side. I wait, but no one comes, and there's no way Rose could be inside and not know someone was at the door. I head back down the stairs and push through the crowds across Ocean Avenue. I start down Shipley Pier toward the Chowder when I spot Davis MacArthur's. He's standing halfway down the pier among the throngs of people,
talking to a girl I recognized from the boathouse when they first caught Gigi. She had argued with Davis about keeping Gigi locked up. His arms are crossed, his eyes surveying the outdoor tables like he's looking for any girl he's missed, who he hasn't yet interrogated for being a Swan sister. A burning fury rises inside me at seeing Davis. But there's nothing I can do. Rose wouldn't be on the pier anyway, not with Davis strutting around. She's probably back at Heath's house, but I don't know where he lives, and I'm not about to ask around and make myself known. So I hurry back to the marina before Davis sees me, and I motor across the harbor to the island. Foretelling. A woman stepped through the door of the Swan Perfumery early one morning on a Thursday, a week after the sisters' night at the tavern. Aurora was sweeping the shop floor. Marguerite was leaning against the counter, daydreaming about a boy she had seen working the rigging on a ship in the harbor the day before, and Hazel was scribbling notes on a piece of paper for a new scent she had been imagining. Myrrh, tansy, and rose hips. A fragrance to ease sadness and clear away mistrust in others. When the woman entered, Marguerite straightened and smiled pleasingly, as she did whenever a new customer visited the shop. "Good morning," Marguerite spoke elegantly, as if she were raised by royals, when in fact all three sisters were raised by a woman who'd lewdly dabbed perfume between her thighs to entice her lovers. The woman did not respond, but walked to a wall of bottled perfumes, all containing hues of citrus and other fruit, meant for daytime wear, often cajoling memories of late summer winds and warm evenings. "A perfume shop seems a tad presumptuous in this town," the woman finally spoke. "Illicit, even." "Women in any town deserve the allure of a good scent," Marguerite responded, raising an eyebrow. Marguerite did not show it, but she recognized the woman. She was the wife of a man Marguerite had flirted with outside the Collins and Gray General Store 3 days earlier. "Allure," the woman repeated. "An interesting choice of words. And this allure," she paused, "it comes from the spells you cast in your sense?" Marguerite's mouth quirked sharply upward on one side. "No spells, madam. Just perfectly arranged fragrances, I assure you." The woman glared at Marguerite, then swiftly moved toward the door. "Your devious work will not go unnoticed for long. We see what you really are." And in a whir of salty sea air, she opened the door and hurried back out onto the street, leaving the three sisters staring after her. "They really do think we're witches, don't they?" Hazel said aloud. "Let them think it. It gives us power over them," Marguerite answered. "Or it gives them a reason to hang us," Aurora added. Marguerite sauntered to the center of the store, winking back at her sisters. "The boys all seem to like it," she replied with a sway of her hips. Both Hazel and Aurora laughed. Marguerite had always been unabashed, and they admired this quality in her, even if at times it got her into trouble. The three sisters were close, devoted to one another, their lives interwoven as tightly as a sailor's knot. They didn't yet know the things that would divide them. For in a place like Sparrow, rumors spread quickly, like smallpox or cholera, confusing the mind, rooting itself into the fabric of a town until there's no telling truth from speculation. Chapter 12. I dial Rose's cell when I get back to the house, but she doesn't answer, so I leave a message. "Call me when you get this." I don't know why she went to see Gigi at the boathouse, but whatever the reason, I need to tell her to stay away. Through the kitchen window, I see Mom standing out on the cliff, her black robe billowing around her legs with an updraft of wind. She didn't stay in bed all day after all. I wait by the phone for most of the day, but Rose never calls. I dial her number 3 more times, but she doesn't answer. Where is she? When the sun starts to settle over the ocean, I curl up in bed, knees to chest. I fall asleep with the wind rattling the glass in the windows, the sea air driving against the house. Just after dawn, it starts raining, gently pattering against the roof. The sky is painted in brushstroke ribbons of violet and coral pink. I stay in my room, but still no word from Rose. The rain keeps everyone inside. Mom locks herself in her bedroom, and I don't see Beau leave the cottage all day. There are things I should say to him, confessions buried inside me. The way my heart feels unmoored when I'm with him, my head loose with thoughts I can't explain. I should say I'm sorry. I should walk down there through the rain and beat my fist against his door. I should touch his skin with my fingertips and tell him there are things I want, I crave. But how do you let yourself unravel in front of someone, knowing your armor is the only thing keeping you safe? So I don't say anything. I keep my heart hidden deep and dark in my chest. Evening eventually presses down, and I slump in the chair beside my bedroom window, watching the sky peel apart and the rain clouds fade. Stars illuminate the dark. But I feel anxious, wishing Rose would just call, explain why she went to the boathouse. She's acting suspicious, making herself seem like one of them. Why? And then I see something through the window. Movement down on the path. A silhouette passing beneath a cascade of blue moonlight. It's Beau, and he's heading toward the dock. And in my gut, I sense that something isn't right. I pull on a long black sweater over my cotton shorts and tank top and hurry down the stairs to the front door. The air hits me as soon as I step outside, a blast of cold that cuts straight down to my marrow. I lose sight of him for a moment, the darkness absorbing him. But when I reach the point in the path where it slopes down toward the water, I see him again, and he's almost to the dock. The evening wind has stirred up from the west, and it pushes waves against the shore in intervals, spilling up over the rocks and leaving behind a layer of foam. Everything smells soggy from the rain. My bare feet are slapping against the wood walkway, but I still catch up to him just as he stops at the far end of the dock. Beau? I ask, but he doesn't move, doesn't turn to look at me, like he can't even hear me. And I already know. Under the dark sky and the pale, swollen moon, I can tell he's not himself. I take 2 careful steps toward him. Beau, I say again, trying to get his attention, but in one swift motion, he steps forward and falls straight off the edge of the dock and down into the water. No! I yell, scrambling forward. The harbor heaves and churns. He's already gone under, sunk beneath the waves. I hold my breath, counting the seconds. How long does he have until there's no more air left in his lungs? I scan the water, afraid to blink. Then, 10 yards out, he appears, sucking in a breath of air as he breaks through the surface. But he doesn't turn back for shore. He doesn't even look over his shoulder. He keeps going, swimming farther out into the harbor. No, this is bad. I strip out of my black sweater and drop it onto the dock. I draw in a deep breath, reach my arms over my head, and dive in after him. The cold water cuts through my skin like needles. And when I gulp in the night air, it stings the inner walls of my lungs. But I start swimming. He is already a good distance ahead of me, determined, being beckoned deeper into the bay. But my arms and legs find a fluid rhythm that is faster than his. His feet, still in his shoes, kick little explosions of water out behind him. When I'm finally within reach, I grab onto his t-shirt and pull hard. His arms stop circling overhead, and his legs pause their kicking. He lifts his head, Hair slicked sideways over his forehead, lips parted, and looks at me.
Beau,
I say, meeting his stony eyes. His eyelashes drip with seawater, his expression slack, unaware of where he is or what he's doing.
We need to go back,
I yell over the wind. He doesn't shake his head, doesn't protest, but he also doesn't seem to register anything I've said, because he drops his gaze and roughly pulls away, resuming his swim across the harbor. I suck in a few quick breaths. The beam of light from the lighthouse circles around, sweeping over the harbor and illuminating the masts of sunken ships. He's being summoned to the wreckage by her.
Shit!
My skin is chilled and weighted from my clothes, but I push my legs out behind me and swim after him, through the dark, knowing that a boat passing through the harbor likely wouldn't see us in time. We'd be forced under by the bow, churned up by the prop, and might never come back up again. But if I let him go, I know what will happen. I will lose him for good. I kick hard, my arms cutting through the water, the cold starting to slow my heartbeat, and the blood pumping out to my extremities. But after several more rotations of the lighthouse, the only thing marking time, I manage to catch up to him again. I wrap my fist around the hem of his shirt and yank him back toward me. He turns to look at me, the same expression etched permanently on his face.
You need to wake up, I scream at him. You can't do this.
His eyebrows pucker a fraction of an inch. He hears me, but he's also lost to Marguerite, her voice cycling through his mind, calling to him, begging him to find her somewhere out there.
Beau,
I say, harder this time, twisting my other fist around his shirt and pulling him closer to me. My legs kick quickly beneath me to keep from sinking under.
Wake up!
He blinks. His lips are ghostly, lost of all color. He opens his mouth, squints slightly, and a word forms softly against his lips.
What?
She's in your head, making you do this. You need to get her out. Ignore what she's telling you. It's not real. Several yards ahead toward the mouth of the harbor, the bell buoy rings against the force of the waves. An eerie sound that rolls across the water.
I need to find her,
he says, voice slurred. I know the image she has placed in his mind. Of her, swimming in a pearl-white dress, fabric thin and transparent, swirling around her body, hair long and silken, her beguiling voice slipping into his ears. Her words promise warmth. The velvet of her kiss and her body pressed to his. He is caught in her spell. She will drown him like all the others.
Please,
I beg, staring into eyes that can't focus, that only see her.
Come back with me.
He shakes his head slowly.
I can't.
I clench my jaw and wrap my hands around the back of his neck, forcing him so close that our bodies slide weightlessly together. I do it without thinking, without breathing. I crush my lips to his. Water spills between us, and I taste the sea on his skin. I dig my nails into the base of his neck, trying to spur him from his waking dream. My heartbeat drives against my chest, and I press my lips harder. I open my mouth to feel the warmth of his breath, but he doesn't move, doesn't react. Maybe this won't work. Maybe it was a mistake. But then, one of his arms slides around me, bracing against my shoulder blades. His mouth parts open, and the heat from his body suddenly pours into me. His other hand finds my cheekbone, and then weaves through my hair. He draws me in deeper, folding me in the circle of his arms. And with my lips, I wipe away the memory of Marguerite Swan from his mind. I take him from her, and he lets me. He kisses me like he wants me more than he's ever wanted anything. And for a second, none of it feels real. I am not swimming in the harbor, wrapped in Beau's arms, his mouth sweeping over mine, my heart pattering wildly against the cage of my chest. We are somewhere else, far away from here, coiled against each other under a warm sun with warm sand at our backs and warm breath on our lips. Two bodies bound together, fearing nothing. And then he pulls his mouth away, slowly, water dripping between us, and everything focuses into a single narrow pinprick. I expect him to release me, to resume his swim across the harbor, but he keeps a hand tangled at the back of my skull and the other against my back, our legs kicking rhythmically beneath us.
"Why did you do that?"
he asks, his voice raw and near breaking. "To save you." His eyes glance out at the dark, forbidding sea, as if waking up from an all-too-real nightmare. "We need to get back to shore," I tell him, and he nods, understanding, his eyes still bleary and unfocused, like he's still not entirely sure where he is or why. We swim side by side back to the dock. We've drifted farther away from it than I realized, the current drawing us out to sea, and after several minutes of swimming hard, we finally reach it. He wraps his hands around my waist and hoists me up to the edge of the dock, and then he pulls himself up after. We're too cold to speak, collapsing onto our backs on the dock, heaving in the chilled night air. I know we need to get inside and get warm before hypothermia sets in. A real possibility out here. So I touch his hand and we both rise, jogging up the wood path to his cottage. We tug off our shoes, and Beau kneels down beside the fireplace. A few embers are still alive beneath the charred logs, while I curl up on the couch with two wool blankets held tightly over my shoulders. Otis and Olga appear from the bedroom, stretching and looking sleepy. They've been spending all their time in here with Beau. They like him. Maybe more than they like me. Beau adds more logs to the fire, and I crawl onto the floor beside him, stretching out my arms to warm my palms against the meager flames. My teeth chatter, and my fingertips are wrinkled.
"You're freezing,"
he says, looking down at my trembling body beneath the blankets.
"You need to get out of those clothes."
He stands up and walks back into his bedroom, returning a moment later with a plain white t-shirt and a pair of green boxer shorts.
"Here," he says. "You can wear these."
I consider telling him that I'm fine, but I'm not fine. My shorts and tank top are so drenched that they're starting to soak the blankets as well. So I stand up, thank him, and take the clothes into the bathroom. The white tile floor is cold beneath my feet, and for a moment I stand scanning the tiny bathroom. A razor and a toothbrush sit beside the sink. A towel hangs from the rack. Hints that someone has been living in this cottage after so many years vacant. I slog out of my clothes, then drop them heavily onto the floor in a pile. I don't even bother folding them. Beau's shirt and boxers smell like him, minty and sweet, but also like a forest. I take in a deep breath and close my eyes before stepping back out into the living room. The fire now crackles and flames spark up the chimney, filling the cottage with warmth. I sit on the floor beside Beau and pull the blankets around me. He doesn't turn to look at me. He is staring into the flames, biting his lower lip. While I was in the bathroom, he changed into dry jeans and a dark blue t-shirt. Both of us are now rid of our waterlogged clothes.
"What happened out there?"
he asks. I tighten the blankets across my chest. The rain batters against the roof. The wind howls. "You were being led into the harbor."
"How?" You know how. Olivia, he says, as if the name has been trapped on his lips for days.